Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. I got an interesting guest for you today. A couple days ago, I sat down with Ron Klain. We wanted to do more than just a 5 to 8 minute TV conversation, so we had a 30-minute conversation. We talked about seemingly everything, including the stalled Democratic agenda, immigration, Ukraine, even House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Just a note, we did record this on Monday. It was before the latest inflation numbers came out and before President Biden accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of genocide. So if you're wondering why there wasn't specific references to those two headlines, that's your answer. And so with that, here's Ron Klain and the Chuck Toddcast. This is one of those. My guest truly needs no introduction. He's the White House Chief of Staff. He's Ron Klain. Ron, welcome to the Toddcast.
Thanks for having me, Chuck.
Don't want to waste any time. Let me start with what I assume, and I'm going to try to start, I would assume, maybe in the order of how you have to deal with your day on any given day. And I assume that that isn't, you have no 2 days are alike. But I want to start with you reacting to a quote that Amy Acton, who was the head of public health for Ohio, early on in the pandemic. I'm sure you remember her. She had this great quote that I've been thinking about a lot when it comes to the war in Ukraine. And she says, when you look back after a pandemic, you never regret the things that you did. You regret the things that you didn't do. How much do you watch what's happening in Ukraine every morning? How much is that senior meeting when you're having your briefing? Do you guys look around and wonder, are we going to regret what we didn't do versus versus having regrets about what you did do?
Well, Chuck, look, obviously, we're always looking to do more, but I wake up every morning and think in some ways just the exact opposite, which is we are seeing Ukraine defeat the second largest army in the world in pushing back its attack around its capital and around the most populous parts of its country. That's a military victory that almost every expert would have told you was completely and totally impossible 2 months ago. Why has that happened? It's happening in part because of the bravery and the character and the determination of the Ukrainian people. But it's happening also in part because of the extraordinary amount of military assistance we flowed into Ukraine before the war began and since the war started. 500 pieces of ammunition for each one Russian soldier that's invading Ukraine. 10 anti-tank weapons for each one Russian tank inside Ukraine. 3 anti-armor weapons for each one armored Russian unit. So we do wake up every day, Chuck, and ask, hey, what more can we do? Particularly right now, we're focused on getting kind of more sophisticated and elaborate systems into Ukraine. There's a lot of complicated logistics around that. But in terms of doing a lot, I don't think you can ever find a time when the United States and its allies did as much as quickly with such a decisive impact as the assistance we've given to Ukraine, both before and since this invasion started.
I hear that. I guess I look at it almost more out of that, you know, the phrase never again, the sort of that, look, and I understand you got to have, this is head and heart, and this is why you guys are there. These are not easy decisions. But Ukraine has to win this war now. Like there's no, it feels like we've crossed over a threshold where building an exit ramp for Vladimir Putin seems like an impossible task. Is that fair?
I don't know about an exit ramp for Vladimir Putin. I don't think that's our concern. Our concern is punishing the Russian aggression and defending the rights of the Ukrainians to have the kind of future they deserve. And that's what our military support is enabling. You know, never again involves a robust and, in this case, a highly militarized response to aggression of the sort we're seeing from Putin. And again, as I said before, Chuck, the success the Ukrainian military has had in driving the Russian military out, the success that our sanctions have had in strangling the Russian economy. When this war began, Russia was one of the top 10 economies in the world. Another month or two, they're not even going to be in the top 20. And the Russian economy has been set back decades by what we've done to them. So we sadly, given that people, humans are who they are, cannot prevent evil in the world. Evil exists. But we certainly can punish it, and we certainly can help those who are fighting back against it do that. And that's what we've been doing with our support for Ukraine.
Is there a point where our policy shifts where Ukraine has to win this war? That has to push Russia out?
Well, I think that what ends the war is always going to be up to the Ukrainian people. And so I'm going to leave that to them to decide where the final lines are, obviously.
Well, if they're not interested in negotiating their sovereignty, right?
Nor should they be, certainly.
But some of the Europeans, you know, obviously they would like to see an end to this sooner rather than later. And they'd like, so there was no doubt, and maybe that has gone away over the last week or two, as we've seen but if they don't want to negotiate their sovereignty, we're going to stick by them.
We are going to stand by Ukraine, and I believe our allies will stand with us. President's united, a coalition that's more united than it's ever been in Europe, both in terms of standing behind the Ukrainians militarily and in terms of those sanctions. And we're going to stand with Ukraine for as long as Ukraine's in this war.
Let me shift to the domestic world here and start with the elusive agenda. All right, the elusive Build Back Better. And I don't want to sit here and say I'm setting aside the bipartisan infrastructure deal, American Rescue Plan. Those are significant achievements. But obviously, there's a big chunk of next achievements you want to get done. Before I get into a little bit of the politics of it, what's realistically achievable between now and November?
Well, I think we have a robust agenda between now and November that does include the reconciliation bill. But not only the reconciliation bill, we need to get COVID relief done. We COVID aid to fund the continued battle against COVID. We're working very hard on this bipartisan innovation bill, the semiconductors bill, the chips bill. It's had a bunch of different names in both chambers of Congress, but whatever you call it.
Doesn't help the sales pitch, but
yeah. It's a very important piece of legislation for us that has helping to fix the supply chain at stake, and also a lot of good-paying high-tech jobs in the Midwest at stake. That's a very important thing to us. I imagine at some point in time we'll have to go back to Congress for more money to fight this war in Ukraine. Congress has been very generous so far, but if it goes on, we're going to need more help because these weapons are not free. Right. So we've got a bunch of agenda items like that, and also the president's laid out what we called in the State of the Union the unity agenda. Issues like mental health, fighting opioids, doing more to fight crime, doing more to try to control other kinds of fighting cancer, other diseases, things like that. So that's all part of the agenda. Reconciliation is part of that. And I think we've got a lot to do and just a few months left in Congress to do it. And I think it's going to be pretty jam-packed.
You led by saying the word reconciliation, which I want to sort of unpack because that to me has been the biggest problem with this bill and the biggest reason why nobody understands what's in it. Nobody knows what's in it because I would argue you guys, and I say you guys, meaning generally Democratic leadership, and you could say White House went along, is how you were going to pass the bill became the lead rather than what's in the bill becoming the topic of conversation. And I understand the logistics of vote counting, but Do you accept the critique that having tried to doing this issue by issue, you would at least have the public understanding who was standing in the way of your agenda and who wasn't?
Well, Chuck, I guess I don't. I mean, I don't want to get too much into legislative mechanics, but that they are a reality here. We're allowed to pass under the congressional rules one reconciliation bill a year. Mm-hmm. So there was no way to chop this up into many pieces and move them separately unless you were going to move any one of the pieces after the first one with 60 votes in the Senate.
Well, so you could get caught trying, not have it work, and then say, okay, now we'll use reconciliation. Like, that's the part
of this. And then, Chuck, look, and then you're saying, part of why the would political... you wait so long? It's too late.
I get it. Right? No. And I get it.
Issues,
it's overlearning. It's overlearning the healthcare lesson. Right?
We either pass them or we wait too long or whatever. And so, look, I'm comfortable with the strategy that we launched. It got the bill. I rarely hear we move too fast. That's an interesting critique. I often hear we move too slow. Maybe we move just right. Who knows? What I know is that that bill passed the House with virtually every single Democrat voting for it. What I know is that bill has 48 of the 50 Democrats. There's actually never been a major legislative proposal in my time as Washington that has much Democratic support behind it. What I obviously state the obvious, we're two votes short. And so we have to come back and figure out what formula works with the 50 to get it passed in the Senate. You know, we're not there. That's for sure.
Was Manchin and Sinema handled incorrectly?
Look, I'm not going to talk too much about our relationships with specific senators. I think it's more effective if we don't. But I also accept the verdict that unless and until we pass a bill, people can question our strategy for trying to pass it. I mean, that's the way this works. We succeeded in passing the rescue plan. We succeeded in passing the infrastructure bill. We succeeded in raising the debt ceiling. We succeeded in passing an omnibus funding bill, which funded many of the president's priorities, put more cops on the street, increased our efforts to fight cancer. We succeeded in getting a black woman confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm proud of our successes in the legislative process. Obviously, we have not yet succeeded in passing this bill.
There is a, you know, the way I hate the words conventional wisdom, but there is a caricature of conventional wisdom out there in Washington that says you're the voice of progressives in these negotiations. Sometimes that's said as a compliment, and sometimes that is said derisively. Fair?
I don't think so. I'm the voice of President Biden in these negotiations. Mm-hmm. And my goal is to try to put together something on this reconciliation bill, which we've always known is going to be a Democrats only bill, that can get the votes of every single Democrat in the Senate, and that can get the votes of all but the one or two Democrats we can afford to lose in the House. And that involves trying to bring together a wide array of people. We can't pass a reconciliation bill unless both Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin vote for it. Mm-hmm. That is a fact.
And why haven't the two of them been in a room? And I've seen, I love that.
They have been in a room.
With the president, the three of you together going, where can we get to an agreement?
So the two of them have been in a room together. Each of them have been in a room with the president. We've had a number of other people in rooms. I think obviously we have a very diverse party with a wide array of views. We're a broad coalition, and that coalition has come together with unprecedented success. We passed more legislation by dollar volume Joe Biden's first year than any president in the history of this country. In addition, as I said, got a Supreme Court nomination from, got more judges confirmed in the past 14 months than any president in the history of this country. So I think we've had a lot of success. This bill is an important bill that we haven't gotten done, but there are a lot of things that we have gotten done.
I'm going to try at least a prioritization here a little bit. When it comes to, I think about the various promises you're making here, whether it's universal pre-K, preparing some, trying to improve our ability to prepare for climate change. To me, the promise that's been hanging out there the longest is lowering the cost of prescription drugs. I put together a montage of TV ads, and I think in a segment a couple weeks ago, about showing Democrats running for Congress in 2010, right, or 2012 and 2014, and say, you know, it has been this sort of, you know, meatball that's hanging out there. At a minimum, do you have to have that in the fall to go to the voters with?
I certainly hope we have it. We certainly should have it. As you say, it's something Congress has talked about for a long time.
And there claims to be bipartisan support for this. You know, how to do it, right? Everybody says they're for this. This is one of those, yes, are you for this? The answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, people say it. Certainly, what I'd say is it has broad bipartisan support among voters. It has broad bipartisan support in the country. As we saw recently, when the House passed a $35 cap on insulin prices, I think there were 12 or 13 Republicans out of, you know, like less than 10% of the Republicans, but there were some Republicans. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think there's really no excuse for not getting prescription drugs done. I absolutely agree with that.
Let me pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like
NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
Were you surprised to see in this upcoming book that's coming out that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, didn't have such kind things to say about you?
Well, Speaker and I have a great relationship. I'm not sure where that comes from, but I have a the Speaker and I talk regularly. We have a very good relationship. I feel very good about where I stand with the Speaker.
Do you think something like that is a moment of frustration? Is that your assumption on something like that?
I'm going to let the Speaker comment on her own comments. As I said, she and I have had for a long time and have now a very good relationship.
Going back to being the voice of progressives, progressives do look at you as sort of a protector here, that you have been a sort of keeper of this. How would you explain that?
Well, as I said before, my job is to try to be a protector of everyone who has interest in the Biden presidency. That includes progressives, includes moderates. Not often enough, it includes Republicans. I hope I have good relations with people from all wings of our party. I think I do. I don't particularly single out one wing over the other. It's a math fact that most Democrats on Capitol Hill are progressive.
Do you think the elected party is more progressive than the voters, than the Democratic voters you need to win over?
I don't know, Chuck. I do think that I think that our party represents our voters much better than the Republican Party represents its voters. And we have a very diverse party in both the House and the Senate. I try very hard to work with people from all wings of the party. And so that just is what it is, I guess.
Let me ask you about Title 42. I've digested the deep dive, the larger, and I'm sure you have some issues with how that story was reported in the Times. But let me start with this basic piece of analysis, and I'm curious of your thoughts on it. That if you brought the 2013 immigration deal to this Senate, not only would you not have the same number of Republicans supporting it, but you wouldn't have the same number of Democrats. Do you accept the idea that whatever the middle ground was in 2013, the two parties are probably farther away from a compromise than ever before?
It's interesting, Chuck. I'm not sure we would have fewer Democrats. Maybe. I really haven't thought much about that. We'd certainly have fewer Republicans. That's that's for sure. President Biden kept his commitment and sent an immigration reform bill to the Congress on his very first day in the White House. I remember him doing that, his first president ever to do that. And we haven't had success in moving that immigration bill. And now we have the situation we have. So I certainly agree with your core point that the prospects for bipartisan immigration action seem remote. But hopefully people will come to their senses and do something about this.
I sit here and I look at When you look at our supply chain issue and you look at this issue with inflation, one of the glaring problems we have is a labor shortage, right? That is having a huge impact on arguably it's having, the upward pressure on wages coupled with obviously just basic, the idea that there's, some things not getting done because of a labor shortage. We could fix this by opening the doors a little bit more, but I know that comes with a political price. Is there a way to open the immigration worker door without creating a political nightmare?
Well, again, I think the president's immigration reform bill, which proposes ways to broaden lawful immigration, which give out more visas for different kinds of workers, I think is part of that solution. And I do think that we do need immigration reform. Look, we do have a broken system. We do need to fix it. I do think immigration reform is part of that. I think obviously there are other ways to also broaden the workforce, get people better training, move other people into the workforce. We've seen a lot of progress on labor force participation the past few months. We're finally getting pretty close to back to where we were pre-pandemic. We need to continue to, again, try to broaden the workforce, bring more workers in.
You were a chief of staff to a vice president, I think twice, correct?
Twice, yeah. Yes. Two vice presidents.
There's no doubt nobody was better prepared for White House chief of staff, arguably, than you. What weren't you prepared for?
I think I don't know that an administration has come in, perhaps since FDR's, perhaps ever, with the kind of array of problems we've had to face. We came into an economy that was completely dead in the water, 50,000 jobs a month, virtually no job creation, and half the schools closed. On top of that, or in part related to that, a public health crisis like we haven't really seen since 1918. And exacerbating that, a divided country about what to do about that public health crisis. Divided country even about things as simple as getting vaccinated in response to an infectious disease. And so we've had to manage all that. And now, in the recent months, we've had to manage, on top of that, the first war in Europe of this size and scope we've seen since World War II. So you have, a World War II-sized, not quite World War II-sized, but the first major war in Europe. You got a pandemic. You got an economic problem. That's a lot to all juggle at the same time. And then to do it with a Senate that is evenly divided, a House that is virtually evenly divided, gives us little margin for error as we try to move things through the legislative process to address those things. So it's a very, very difficult set of challenges with a very, very complicated set of tools to address them.
I'm curious, does the fear of losing the House and Senate serve as a motivator to maybe get I look at what you guys are staring at and looking at how immigration held COVID funding hostage, and it feels like, the campaign is beginning sooner than you guys need, right? If campaign politics is front and center to electeds, it's harder to get anything passed. But I'm curious, is the threat of losing the House and the Senate, and the fact that many election analysts are already writing the House off, Donald Trump's doing everything he can to help you guys out in the Senate, I think. But does that serve as a motivator on Capitol Hill to get more compromises?
Well, I think what really serves as the motivator, Chuck, is understanding that the calendar has only so many months in it left in this year. And without regard to what it looks like in 2023, again, I'm here in my office. I got to be careful about the Hatch Act. I am probably one of the most optimistic people about what 2023 is going to look like. I actually think, we have a good lineup in the Senate, good lineup in the House. But the point is that 2023 is next year. We need to deliver results for the American people this year. Mm-hmm. And this year really means, five remaining months, one of which is August, where very little gets done. And so we really have to move the key pieces of legislation left to be moved through the House and Senate with tempo.
Given the way our election cycles work, what is your realistic window? Is it to Labor Day? I mean, is that the way you look at it?
I don't know. I mean, there's always some things that happen in September. But certainly the period between now, when the House and Senate get back after the...
I saw that 4th of July thrown out there as an unofficial deadline. What do you make of that?
I don't know.
Need to have some structure by then, knowing what it could look like. Is that fair?
I think the important thing is for us to work well with the House and Senate leadership, as we have all year, mm-hmm. to move things through in each work period, to have significant legislative victories in each work period. That's the important thing, and that's what we're aimed on.
Do you have a point where you accept that more of the president's time has to be devoted to politics? I'm sure there's all these demands He's got a lot going on.
Yeah.
How much do you have to sort of hold that back, if you will? Because there's certainly a lot of demand as the campaign.
Again, I want to be respectful of my Hatch Act obligations here.
Of course.
What I will say is, historically, Joe Biden has been a very active campaigner in the fall, whether that's in off-year elections, whether that was in 2010 or 2014 or even in 2018 when he wasn't even an elected official. And I expect the American people will see him out there this fall as well.
Is there give me a sense of your day. Like, I'm just curious, what time do you get up? How much are you reading in? And what's something that you feel you get left undone on a given day that you wish you couldn't?
Well, I'm usually in the office around 6:45 each day and read my intelligence briefing first thing when I get in. Have some early morning meetings with the president, participate also most days in his daily intelligence briefing. Have a lot of internal staff meetings in the morning. And then, you know, spend most of the afternoon on policy meetings in terms of our initiatives that we're developing and pushing through. And then usually, again, have some time.
So when do you read? What you just described was a lot of meetings.
When do you get to I read my intelligence briefing. I read a lot of summaries of different news sources. On Sundays, I watch Meet the Press. I read basically a collection of news clippings and a collection of our, more importantly, perhaps a collection of our intelligence materials from around the world to stay up on what's going on.
Let me ask the final question there, and I know I promised I'd keep this stay in the window, which is every White House believes they don't have a message problem, they have a communications problem. So I'm going to accept the idea that you have a communications problem. Do you think it's a solvable problem, or do you think the media landscape is so fractured that it's a near impossible task to break through?
Look, it's our job to communicate with the American people and do it the best way we can. I'm not going to sit here and complain about the media landscape or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think that obviously there is a lot going on. And so, look what we did the past 2 weeks. We released a budget that reduced the deficit more than any president in history, $1 trillion cut in the deficit. We expanded the Affordable Care Act to 5 million more families with President Obama here at the White House. We obviously confirmed a Supreme Court justice. We made the largest release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in history and then matched it with a coordinated release with our allies for the largest reserve they'd ever done. And as a result of all that, we dropped the price of oil by 20% the past 3 weeks. A very robust domestic agenda, I think, by any objective.
Yeah, I think Larry Summers on my show praised the oil release.
There you go. And yet, obviously, what dominates the news, understandably, is the war in Ukraine. And I don't know how successful we were in getting all these domestic things I just discussed out to the American people to hear, given what's going on in Ukraine. That's not a criticism of the media. That's not a criticism necessarily of us. It's just a reality of the world we live in. And so that's something we struggle with every day. We know that we're hearing from the American people. They want to hear what we're doing here at home in addition to what we're doing to lead in Europe. We're trying to get that through. It's very hard to get through. I think in the end, what matters is that we're doing our jobs, we're making progress on these problems, and that's what the American people have to see. And we're going to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it see where it all winds up.
You know, I've been obsessed with the 1942 midterms didn't go so well for the incumbent party in the White House. I mean, even during World War II, the focus of the country is usually on domestic issues.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see. Like I say, again, without violating the Hatch Act, I'm pretty optimistic actually about the fall. And
makes you optimistic? Is it simply
that would definitely violate the Hatch Act, and also it would violate our time here. But when you look at the map and you look at the candidates,
you look at the geography and you look at sort of the landscape and think this could have been a whole lot worse.
Correct.
All right.
I got to leave it there.
I don't think I got you in trouble, but it sounds like you're nervous about it. So
I am nervous about it.
Ron Klain, your first job in politics was driving Evan by Birch by, isn't that right?
Birch by.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, Birch by back in 1980. Yeah,
it is. It is a reminder that the single best job in campaign politics is driver, right?
It's one of those. It is one of the best jobs. Although, this was. I know it's hard for young people to believe. This was before GPS. This was before cell phones.
You had to use actual triptychs and maps, huh?
You had to know where you were going and had to use a map to get there. It was a hell of a lot harder back then, I promise you.
You and Mark Warner are my two favorite examples of guys who got their start in politics as drivers. I think Mark Warner was a driver for Doug Wilder back in the day or something like that. So,
all right, Chuck, thanks so much.
Mr. Klain, thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gopin Green and Matt Rivera. Our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC. It's every day at 1 p.m. Eastern. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. Subscribe now if you haven't. And the big show is available every Sunday morning on your local NBC station. Thanks for listening. Until we upload again.